This weekend, Islington branch of the Socialist Party has organised an education conference on the subject of socialist women. And over the next two afternoons, we shall be examining and discussing various aspects of society of specific interest to women and to men also, we hope, and relating these to the arguments for the socialist alternative to capitalism. There will be four sessions in all, each one consisting of a talk by a socialist, followed by a discussion period when you, the audience, are invited to contribute. That's a lot for me at the moment. I'm now going to introduce Karima Mohideen, who's going to start the conference off, and she's going to discuss women under capitalism. Karima.
You might have found the words of the song on your seat. We're not actually going to have a sing-along. It's just for you to look at while we're waiting to start. Anyone who wants to volunteer to sing later, welcome to. But if you haven't had a chance to read it, don't worry, you can look at it later. But I just thought it was the words illustrate quite well the experience of many working-class women under capitalism. Working-class women under capitalism have to work extremely hard, either as wives and mothers, or waged and salaried workers, or often as both. In addition to this, women are expected to accept a subordinate role in society, not only in relation to the capitalist class, as men are, but also in relation to their fellow workers, men. As a consequence, many women will tend to blame men for their problems, and indeed some women have suffered a great deal at the hands of men. But men are not the cause of women's oppression. The source of men's and women's oppression is the capitalist system under which we live and the social relationships and attitudes that have developed as part of it. However, I just want to make the point that while sexist behaviour can be explained in social and economic terms, this does not excuse it. And women and men who are committed to changing society must overcome the prejudices and attitudes ingrained in them by their socialisation in order to bring about that change. I just want to talk briefly about how capitalism affects our lives. We live in a class-divided society. One class, a minority of women and men, own and control the resources of the earth and the means of adapting and distributing them so that they can be used. The rest of us have to work for this class in order to get access to the things we need in order to live. We rely on a wage or salary or social security in order to get access to the food we've produced and the homes we've built. The driving force of this system is profit. Nothing is produced unless it's profitable to do so, regardless of what people need. This is why millions of people starve to death every year, even though we could produce enough food for everyone. Under this system, workers are daily forced into competitive social and economic relationships. We have to compete for jobs and access to resources such as medical care and living space. Our success is always precarious. We're only employed while the capitalists need us, and our daily lives are fraught with worrying about bills for basic necessities such as a home to live in and heating. Because of this competitive nature, capitalism breeds divisions between workers, which it manipulates to divert our attention away from the basic class relations of the system. Workers who are forced into competing for jobs and continually misinformed by the education system and the media will blame each other for their poverty, rather than the class that exploits them. For example, white workers in Britain will blame black workers for lack of jobs and housing and so on. The capitalist system is very happy to perpetuate this state of affairs through the media or the education system and in a variety of ways, because this is how it can continue to divert attention away from the fact that a minority of people is exploiting everyone else. In very crude terms, it's called divide and rule. To this end, capitalism fully exploits the biological differences between men and women, along with the traditional cultural practices and attitudes that have developed around these differences. This is the set of social relationships to which us workers are conditioned. In this family group, everyone has a different and restricted role to play. Mum, okay, has the children, because this is, and because of this, she's supposed to look after them and the house, and cook and clean and be generally caring, while Dad is expected to earn a wage or salary with which he can support the whole family and is therefore the head of the household and has control over everyone. But he also has to spend long hours away from his family, working. And the kids have no rights until they're 18 and have to respect their parents and defer to their decisions. They're all supposed to live happily together in their little home and find fulfillment in this set of relationships. The family is presented to us as the natural way for humans to organise themselves, as it is supposedly based on the different sexual functions of men and women. It is an important part of capitalist ideology, but the reality is that families such as the one in the picture are not the norm. They only account for 1/3 of households in Britain, and many of those are not necessarily happy. 1 in 3 marriages end in separation or divorce, while 1 in 100 marriages, women suffer severe violence. So that's extreme violence, whereas in other marriages, it could be slightly less severe forms of violence. The recent media attention is also revealing more and more incidents of child abuse and incest. The family is not a natural institution. Different roles that men and women are conditioned to play within the family are not a natural development of their sexual functions. The family is a social phenomenon which exists within the capitalist system. As such, it has 2 important functions in perpetuating the existence of capitalism. Firstly, it ensures that the physical needs of workers are provided for at no additional expense for the capitalists, and it also ensures that successive generations of workers are reared and socialised into the system, again at no expense to the capitalists. So not only do workers bear the cost of feeding and sheltering themselves so that they're refreshed enough to go to work again the next day, but they also bear the cost of feeding, clothing and sheltering future generations of workers until they're ready for work. During periods of economic recession, workers, as a result of cutbacks, expected to take on greater financial burdens within the family, for example, care of old people or their children's education needs. Secondly, importantly from the point of view of women, by socialising women for the role of wife and mother, capitalism keeps them as a reserve labour force which can be manipulated according to economic needs. For example, during the Second World War, more women workers were needed to replace the men who were away fighting. They were encouraged to take up jobs which had previously been open only to men, for example, engineering. Good childcare facilities were made possible so that women could take up these jobs. But after the war, jobs had to be made available for the men again, and women were made redundant, childcare facilities were withdrawn, and a great deal of propaganda appeared stressing the importance of women's roles as wives and mothers, and suddenly it was found to be psychologically damaging for children to be away from their mothers, especially when they were young. So conditioning women for the role of wife and mother justifies the exploitation of women in low-paid and uninteresting and futureless jobs, because their role as wage workers is seen to be a temporary one until they find a husband or have children, or a supplementary one, working for pin money to supplement their husband's income. And women are conditioned to be submissive as wives and mothers, and this makes it all the easier to keep women in these jobs. As a consequence, women's contribution to societies is devalued. Domestic work is often not recognised as work at all, and in some parts of the world, official reports and statistics often ignore the number of hours women put into tasks such as fetching water, attending vegetables, or looking for fuel, while occupations that have traditionally been regarded as women's occupations are notoriously underpaid, for example, nursing and teaching. Just before I go on to look at how capitalism affects the lives of women in more detail, I'd just like to briefly look at some examples of societies where men and women have equal status and how those societies are organised. And this is based on anthropological evidence, which suggests that the earliest societies, some primitive societies today, for example the Inuit or Eskimo societies, were probably cooperatively organised, with everyone participating in the struggle for survival and sharing the fruits of that struggle. The means of survival was mainly hunting and gathering, and we can reasonably presume that there was no notion of property in such societies, and no property-owning class with economic and political power over everyone else. Therefore, there was no hierarchical social or political structure either. In these societies, work was divided between men and women, depending on the environment and the availability of food. Generally, the men tended to hunt larger animals over longer distances, while the women gathered plants and insects, but this wasn't always the case. Women often took responsibility for building shelters, processing food, and for crafts such as tanning leather, but men would also cooperate in these activities. Now, the most likely reason for this sexual division of labour was that women's mobility was restricted by the fact that they bear children and suckle them for several years. So this division of labour was an efficient way of ensuring the survival of the whole group and was conceived of in terms of shared responsibility. It did not represent inequality of status for either men or women because the lifestyle of the group was communal. So the whole group took responsibility for decision-making and for the children. There was no separation between the domestic world and the public world, so women weren't shut away from the discussion and decision-making processes, while the communal household also enabled everyone to look after children, both men and women, so that the burden didn't fall heavily on one woman or an individual woman as it does in our society. And she was able to do a variety of activities apart from domestic work. Now, just the example I've chosen is Eskimos. In particular, Eskimos prefer to be called Inuit, incidentally, so I'll try and use that term more. Particularly a group of Inuit people called the Naskapi, who are such a society. And Eleanor Leacock, an anthropologist, describes how in many their tribal groups, the Inuit women are strong, independent women with considerable freedom. They often have responsibility for healing and medical affairs and can make decisions that affect the whole tribe. And this was also not just in recent times, but way back in the 17th century, a Jesuit missionary in Labrador stated that the women have great power here. He was talking about this Naskapi tribe. And that the choice of plans and undertakings, of journeys, of wintering, lies in nearly every instance in the hands of the housewife. Eleanor Leacock herself observed among the Naskapi people of Labrador how a man spent most of the day nursing a sick child with great skill, while his wife got on with tanning a caribou skin. The men in this community knew how to cook and look after children without being at all self-conscious about it. It was a natural, something they took as a natural part of their duties. Marriage in these communities was a loose sort of monogamous arrangement which either partner could break off and which did not preclude sexual relationships with other partners. And again, these Jesuit priests were very worried about this because they noticed that the women had considerable sexual freedom in this community. And one of these Jesuit missionaries scolded an Naskapi man, saying, in France, women don't rule their husbands. They saw this as women having control over men. And to make these women obey their husbands became one of the main concerns of these missionaries. The priest continued to explain to the Naskapi that it was not honourable for a woman to love anyone else except her husband, and that this evil, meaning women's sexual freedom, being among them, he himself was not sure that his son, who was there present, was his son. So he's saying, well, how can you be sure that that child is really your son? And the Eskimo had a far wiser reply than the Jesuit could probably imagine. You've not got any sense. That you French people only love your own children. He said, but we love all the children of our tribe. I think that makes an interesting comparison with attitudes towards children and people in general in our society, where people quite have to let children die of starvation in parts of the world and protesting about abortion in this country. It's interesting to compare the lifestyles of these communities and the position of women within them with our technologically much more advanced society. So how does capitalism actually affect the lives of women? It's a huge area, so I'm only going to focus on three main areas. The first of those is work, and then I'll look at some health issues, and finally, at violence. Now, first of all, work. I've already said that women work extremely hard all around the world, whether they stay at home or go out to work. Unlike the so-called ideal family, many working-class women have to go out to work, either because they do not have a husband to support them, or because the husband's income is not enough to meet the family's needs. In 1 in 6 households in Britain, a woman is the main breadwinner. In addition to this, many women also take full responsibility for the home and children, either because the men aren't prepared or aren't encouraged to regard this as their responsibility, or because the men are forced to work a long way from home. And that's the case in some in South African townships, for example, where women stay at home and men work a long way away in mines, and women have to take full responsibility for the home, as well as supplement the husband's income. In some African and Asian countries, a woman's day might run like this. She might spend 10 to 12 hours tapping rubber or plucking tea or working in a factory. Often she'll only get paid if she completes over a minimum amount of work, and that's the case for tea plucking in Sri Lanka. They have to pick, I can't remember how many pounds, but it's quite a large amount before they actually get paid. In addition to that, she'll probably have to spend 2 to 3 hours gathering fuel if she lives in a rural area, which can happen over a wide area looking for firewood. Fetching water, which again can be an arduous journey on foot over several miles. Work in the vegetable garden, cook food, look after her children, and possibly even supplement her meagre income by weaving or some other craft. In addition to this, she bears children and suckles them. Technological developments in some of these countries where women work this hard haven't necessarily worked in favour of women. For example, in India, new high-yielding varieties of rice was introduced, and weeding, which is a traditionally female activity, was increased from 53 days to 63 days an acre when these new kinds of rice were introduced. So, despite formal encouragement of equality of opportunity in many countries, women still generally find themselves in low-paid work with few prospects. For example, they do cleaning work, clerical work, or factory work. Because they bear the main responsibility for the children, they're often forced to take part-time work where they're vulnerable to poor pay and working conditions and little job security. Among the most notorious exploiters of women are firms which produce consumer goods, such as electronic items, clothing and shoes, both in Europe and in Asia and Central America. Particularly in so-called third world countries, where female labour is even cheaper and easier to control because there are fewer controls on labour conditions in these countries. For example, during the 1960s, the United States transferred its electronics industry to South and Central America and Southeast Asia as a result of industrial strife in the United States. In Southeast Asia, in Singapore, Hong Kong, the Philippines and South Korea and other countries in that area, labour is recruited from the countryside to work in these factories by publicising the benefits rather than the monetary returns of working in factories. So women are tempted by air-conditioned work environment, sports facilities, medical facilities, and even beauty grooming classes. Needless to say, workers find that they only have access to these facilities if they're prepared to pay for them out of their meagre wages when they actually get there. While factory conditions are sometimes so oppressive in many of these places, that there have been outbreaks of hysteria among women employees. In Bangladesh, the garment industry provides over 80,000 jobs for women. Compared to the alternatives, such as the construction industry, domestic service, or prostitution, it's a relatively good job. Now, officially, the working hours are from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., but women often work longer, and sometimes they're even locked in overnight to complete an order. In some factories, they're locked in anyway to prevent them from stealing and selling the materials. And a machinist working in such a factory will earn between £2 and £8 a week, according to her skill. In this country, the garment industry also exploits both men and women. I'm just going to give an example of a woman that I know, who's paid £1 a dress. So it's piecework, and if every item is complete, you get paid. I met her at an evening class, and on that day, she'd made a mistake in every single garment, as they'd been laid out for sewing wrongly. And she didn't get paid for anything that day, because she'd made a mistake in every single dress. And she had to do all the unpicking in her own time, so we all did it at the evening class. The view that women are some kind of secondary labour force also affects pay. Women are generally paid less than men, as they're not perceived to be the breadwinner. Even where equal pay laws exist, such as in Britain, the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1975, women's average weekly earnings are still only 66% of men's, because a loophole in the law states that equal pay is guaranteed only for the same or mainly similar work, which meant that jobs could either be redefined as different work, or women could be restricted to occupations where men were not usually employed, so no comparison could be made. But I want to stress the point that under capitalism, the notion of equal pay is pretty meaningless anyway, as no one has equal access to resources. Paying women less meant that men's wages were subject to competition. Furthermore, men saw the entry of women into the labour force as a threat to their jobs, and there is still a strand of thinking within trade unions that sees the concerns of women workers to be different from men workers. And to this day, women attempting to participate in union activity will often encounter blatant sexism and prejudice. It's clear, then, I think, that entry into the labour force, a labour process, hardly represents emancipation for millions of women around the world. It is, in fact, an inevitable development within capitalism which needs to exploit growing numbers of workers. For some women, it's merely doubled the burden of work, as they have to take care of their family as well as go out to work. Others are forced to choose between having children and going out to work, between two different kinds of slavery, domestic slavery or wage slavery. The concessions women gain ebb and flow according to economic need. When capital needs women's labour power, it creates the conditions necessary to enable them to work. But when it no longer needs the women, it takes these concessions away. This is where the family is so useful. In the current economic recession, many jobs in the public sector have been cut back. This has affected many women workers, yet they don't appear in the unemployment statistics, as it is assumed that they've disappeared into their role as wives and mothers. I think it's becoming clear that we have far less choice and far less freedom, despite our sophisticated technology in this capitalist system, than the Naskapi Eskimo women did in their very restricted technological society. As the next area I want to look at is health. I think it's very important to put women's health in the context of a society where the health needs of most workers, whether they're men or women, are inadequately met. All around the world, men, women and children die of diseases that are easy to prevent or cure. Nevertheless, in the struggle for resources imposed upon us by the system, and as a consequence of women's low status, it is often the women who lose out first, and their needs are often neglected, or they encounter hostility and prejudice in trying to make their needs known. I think a classic example of this is to be found in the World Health Organization's research into river blindness, which is a disease which is widespread in many African countries. A woman reading the reports on the project on river blindness discovered that the statistics and other information only referred to men who suffer from the disease. When she challenged the male officials working on the project, this was their surprised response. "The documents only mention men having the disease? I don't believe it. Let me look it up." "Well, how amazing, you're right. Do you know, I've worked on this for years, read that document dozens of times and never noticed that it's only about men. And now I come to think of it, our film only shows pictures of men. But surely the women get it too. I wonder why it was done like that." Similarly, in Bhopal, where the Union Carbide gas disaster killed 3,000 people and injured 200,000 others, Indian government medical research teams established that the effects of gas impaired eyes, lungs, the gastric system, skin and some mental facilities. However, doctors involved in an organisation called Medico Friend Circle, which operates separately from the state healthcare system and community groups, discovered that the gynecological reactions of women to the gas had been ignored by the government research. Their research found that spontaneous abortion after the accident was 4 times higher than before, and women were suffering from a variety of diseases related to their biology as women, such as pelvic inflammatory disease and so on. In the rest of this section on health, I'll focus mainly on the problems of childbearing, but there are a whole lot of other areas in which women's health is affected, so just you should bear that in mind. Time restricts us to, we can't talk about everything. So So despite technological advances in medicine and in nutrition, childbearing for many women in the world is an extremely risky business. The general rule is the poorer you are, the more dangerous having children it is. The world's poorest women are 20 to 30 times more likely to die in childbirth than a woman who has access to good medical facilities and a good diet. So I'm sure Fergie's baby will be fine. But, during pregnancy and nursing, a woman needs extra protein, minerals, vitamins, and energy. In India, among women who subsist on less than 1,800 calories a day, and a human being needs just over 2,000, even more, one-third of these women's pregnancies end in miscarriage or stillbirth, while those children who do survive will be underweight at birth and develop more slowly than a healthy child from a healthy mother. Often, while a woman is pregnant in many of these parts of the world, her work for the family is reduced, and what available food there is goes first to those members of the family who work, and so she loses out. Similarly, as mothers in many traditional societies rely on sons to feed breadwinners who support them in old age, they tend to give more of what little food there is to the boys. And in Bangladesh, 30 to 50% more girls than boys under five die of diseases related to malnutrition. In parts of the world also where men traditionally eat first, there isn't always enough food left for the women. The age at which women have babies and the number of children they have affects the health of the mother and the baby. Again, this is determined by economic circumstances. In many parts of the world, girls are married off at an early age as they're regarded as an economic liability for their parents and as well as traditional customs. Lack of adequate family planning facilities mean that these girls have babies while their bodies are still immature. The babies of these young mothers are far more likely to die, and the young mothers are also at greater risk. In Iran, this is such a common event that they have a saying that the first two are for the crows. Lack of family planning, health education, and health care, as well as the need to rely on children for support in their old age, means that many women in third world countries have more children than their bodies can cope with. This results in them becoming very old and worn out before they're 40. There are so many women like this in Bangladesh that they actually have a name for it, Shutika. I don't know if that's the right way to pronounce it. However, capitalism, while failing to meet the basic needs of mothers and women in general, also makes a profit out of them. Vitamin pills, sanitary towels, maternity and baby clothes, and baby food. I think mother clothes are a good example of a profit-making establishment, profit out of mothers and babies. And it doesn't even manage to provide a crèche or a toilet for its shoppers. Right, so the last section that I want to look at is violence. Under capitalism, many women live in fear of mental and physical violence, both in the home and in public places. We're afraid to walk home alone or use public transport, especially at night. At work, we're subjected to sexual harassment, which often we can't do anything about, as the perpetrator of this is quite often our boss and has the power to sack us or make our lives a misery if we complain. Women are battered by their husbands, their boyfriends, and their sons. As I mentioned before, in 1 in 100 marriages, women suffer severe violence. And I just want to quote someone called Sandra Hawley, who directs a Chiswick Family Refuge, which is a refuge for battered wives. And she describes some of the worst cases. It's a bit nasty. She says, I've come across cases of hammers and chisels in the face, bottles up the vagina, and fractured skulls, broken arms, and cases of rape. Though, incidentally, the law doesn't recognise rape within marriage. Battering can involve mental torture and humiliation as well, such as forcing a woman to beg on her knees for forgiveness, or constantly telling a woman how useless she is until she starts to believe it. And that can start when you're very, very young and go on throughout your life. Rape is not generally committed by some nutto in the grip of an uncontrollable sex drive, but often by men with apparently normal sex lives, and yet they may even be married. In most cases, rape occurs between people who know each other, and it could even be a carefully planned attack. I'll just give you an example of a case study of a 39-year-old woman who was separated from her husband and lived alone with her five children. An attacker broke into her house and raped her. And this attacker then turned out to be a friend, husband, and father of several children. That's cases can often be as ordinary as that. Both in cases of rape and battering, blame is often apportioned to the woman. Statements like, she must have asked for it, are common. While women themselves often feel guilty and as a consequence will keep a sexual attack secret. On the other hand, some people try to explain violence by stating that men are naturally aggressive, which only reinforces the differences between men and women that are encouraged by the system, so it's a misleading argument, and ignores the evidence that some men are not aggressive, while some women are. So violence towards women under capitalism can only be explained within the context of our social structure. First of all, violence is an acceptable feature of our society. Thousands of men, women, and children die in wars. And a punch-up is an acceptable way to express disagreements. Men are encouraged to be aggressive and dominant, whether they want to be or not. Whereas in some societies, people will go to great lengths to avoid violent confrontations. For example, again, the Eskimo society, where they'll settle disputes through singing. Secondly, human relationships are affected by the fact that we live in a hierarchical society in which one group of people has power over everyone else. Workers are generally powerless. They have virtually no say in their lives and their futures and are often forced into situations they cannot control and dislike. For example, unpleasant work or working hours or conditions. And in their social relationships, too, they're forced into roles that restrict their potential for development as individuals. For example, you may be forced to be the breadwinner or the housewife, whether you like it or not. And added to this, the confined environment of marriage and the family acts as a sort of pothouse to increase the frustrations, and generally we can't escape it because we're economically dependent on other people or they're economically dependent on us. Consequently, we take out our frustrations on those very people in ways that come most easily to us. Women can be violent, but they tend not to beat up their husbands, as he can easily walk out, depriving a woman of her children's livelihood. So it's not so easy for her to find a job and support them. So she'll take out her frustrations on her children, which is why a lot of mothers actually battle their children, or on herself, which is why twice as many women suffer from depression as men. Men have been encouraged to express themselves through physical strength in our society. They've also been encouraged to perceive themselves as the breadwinner with power over their household, whether they are or not, in fact, they're still regarded as the head of the household. They return to violence to vent their frustrations in many cases, but the battered wives can't actually leave their husbands because they're not able to support their children on their own. This, I think, compare this with the Eskimos again, would have been far less of a problem for the Eskimo women. First of all, because violence was just far less common, and because a woman was free to leave if she didn't get on with the man she was living with, he beat her up, then she was free to leave because she didn't rely on an individual man for her livelihood any more than she had sole responsibility for her children, the community had responsibility for the children. Rape is also not a crime that happens because men are violent. It is an extreme expression of the power relationships between men and women in our society. As men are expected to support their wives and children within individual families, they also have power over the family as the head of the household. Women have become men's property, which men can protect or dispose of as they wish. For example, daughters in many Asian families are completely under the control of their fathers and brothers, who guard their sexuality until they're married off to a man of the father's choosing. And I know a case of the sister of one of my pupils who was actually dragged by her hair up the stairs and beaten up by her father because she was going out with a boy that he didn't approve of. Women are expected to be passive, and just presented as passive, enticing sex objects who are expected to wait for men to take the lead, a view that's reinforced by pornography and advertising, and which does not present women as people with feelings and ideas. Rape is an extreme expression of this power relationship and is a feature of a society where some people have power over other people's lives.